One of my very favorite characters in all of the New Testament was a member of the Lord's church at Philippi. His name does not occur in Acts chapter 16, where we read about the establishment of the church there in Philippi. In fact, Acts chapter 15 concludes with the information about Paul and Barnabas deciding to go on what we call the second missionary journey. But before they could really even get the journey underway, they had a disagreement, and you remember their dispute, their disagreement was whether or not John Mark should be allowed to go along with them because he had left them on the first journey and gone back home. Paul and Barnabas each felt very strongly about the matter, and in fact they felt so strongly that they finally decided the way to resolve their disagreement was for Barnabas to take John Mark and go on a journey to preach and teach and visit. And Paul would take Silas and go back and visit the congregations that they had begun on their first missionary journey. In Acts chapter 16, we find Paul and Silas joined by a young man that before that time there had been scant mention of, the young man Timothy. Timothy was with Paul and Silas when that vision came to Paul during the night. We referred to it as the Macedonian call. In that vision, you remember, Paul saw a man standing before him, and the man said, "Come into Macedonia and help us." The Bible tells how that Paul and Silas and Timothy immediately went and journeyed until they came to Philippi, the principal city of the region, or the district, as Luke calls it, of Macedonia. Now, you know the rest of the story from there, how that they went to a place that they understood to be a place of prayer where people were obviously getting together on a regular basis to pray and have some kind of devotions or studies. And Paul, of course, began to preach to them. And one of the ones that's named as being one of the first ones to obey the gospel was a woman who was apparently a wealthy businesswoman, a seller of purple, Lydia by name. Not only was she a businesswoman, but she was also very much given to hospitality because she insisted that Paul and his traveling companions stay at her house. During the next several days, Paul and Silas began to be followed by that person who had an evil spirit, who was obviously known for that and was announcing them everywhere they went, saying, "These men are of the Most High God. Listen to what they say." Finally, it came to the point at which, you remember, Paul had seemingly had enough, and so he cast the demon out of the young woman, and when her handlers saw that and saw that their method of earning money from with her had come to an end, they hauled Paul and Silas before the magistrates. They were beaten and put in prison in the innermost dungeon of the prison with their feet held in stocks. And long about midnight, Paul and Silas were singing praises and praying to God, and the other prisoners were listening to them. When that earthquake came and shook the prison to its very foundations, the doors swung open, the stocks were opened, the jailer calling or coming forth and seeing all of the doors open, assumed that the prisoners had escaped, and the Bible says he drew his sword and was about to kill himself when Paul said, "Do thyself no harm, for we're all here." He called for a light, and eventually, and within just a short space of time, he was asking the question to Paul and Silas, "What shall I do to be saved?" Lydia and her family, the jailer and his family, were among the first converts of that congregation there in Philippi that obviously held a very special place in Paul's heart. But I haven't told you yet who the fellow is who is one of my very favorite characters in all of the New Testament. He was a member of the church at Philippi. His name only occurs two times in the entire New Testament. And if you have your Bible open to Philippians chapter 2, in all likelihood, in just that opening of your Bible on those two pages, there is where his name occurs twice. You say, well, how in the world could that man be one of your favorite characters in all of the New Testament when you think about all of the important people, people like the apostles and of course, people like Paul and Barnabas and Timothy and Titus and all of those who are mentioned often and with whom we're so familiar, and yet you've picked out this obscure character that we only have a couple of mentions of his very name, and that's all we know about him. Epaphroditus is one of my very favorite characters in the New Testament because of what Paul says about him here at the end of Philippians chapter 2. The text that I'd like for us to read tonight and discuss is Philippians chapter 2, beginning at verse 25 and reading through verse 30, which is the last verse in the chapter. Actually, the paragraph just before verse 25 kind of introduces the subject matter, because it was in that paragraph that Paul tells the Christians in Philippi to whom he's writing this letter that he intends to send Timothy to them very shortly because he is very much interested in how they are doing. He wants Timothy to go and to bring back word because he says, Timothy is genuinely concerned for your welfare. And he says, you know how important Timothy is to the work of the Lord. He's proven himself. The wording that Paul uses here in the English Standard Version is Timothy's proven worth. How as a son with a father he has served with me in the gospel. And I hope, therefore, to send him just as soon as I see how it will go with me. And then verse 24 says, and I trust in the Lord that shortly I myself will come also. Now verse 25. I have thought it necessary to send to you Epaphroditus, my brother and fellow worker and fellow soldier, and your messenger and minister to my need, for he has been longing for you all and has been distressed because you heard that he was ill. Indeed, he was ill, near to death. But God had mercy on him, and not only on him, but on me also, lest I should have sorrow upon sorrow. I am the more eager to send him, therefore, that you may rejoice at seeing him again, and that I may be less anxious. So, receive him in the Lord with all joy and honor such men, for he nearly died for the work of Christ, risking his life to complete what was lacking in your service to me." As we look at these few verses tonight for just the next few minutes, there are, first of all, three or four observations that I'd like for us to see from the text. And first of all, we'll start with Paul's optimistic expectation. What does he say there in verse 24 after he has said, "I'm going to send Timothy to you because you know how dear he is to me. You know how important he is to the Lord's work. I'm going to send him to you so that he can find out how you are." And then Paul says, "And I trust in the Lord that shortly I myself will come also." Paul's very positive about that, isn't he? He's very optimistic. I make plans all the time. And you do too. Now, there are some plans that I make that have a little bit of an open-ended part to them. If I get around to it, or if the time is right, or if circumstances are just so, then I'm going to do so-and-so. You might say that's planning with optimism. Paul says, "I trust in the Lord that shortly I myself will come also." Now, there's something about that statement there that we haven't really touched on yet. Where is Paul when he's writing this? He's in prison. Paul is not optimistic. I've got the wrong word up there on the screen. He is full of faith. He says, "I trust the Lord that I'm going to come shortly myself." Oh, Paul, is your case about to be closed? Not so far as we can tell. Has the Roman government decided to drop their charges against you? No indication of that whatsoever thus far. But Paul says, "I trust in the Lord," or "I trust the Lord that I shortly myself will come to see you also." The second observation I'd like for us to notice is the fact that he tells them in verse 26, "I'm sending Epaphroditus back." Actually, in verse 25, he says, "I have thought it necessary to send to you Epaphroditus." You see, Epaphroditus had come from the church at Philippi. He had brought to Paul some things that were needed and probably some monetary support. Paul makes reference to that fact again in verse 28 of chapter 4, of chapter 4, which is actually the second time that he mentions Epaphroditus' name. He says, "I'm well supplied, having received from Epaphroditus the gifts you sent, a fragrant offering, a sacrifice acceptable and pleasing to God." Now, what does that tell us? I think that tells us that Epaphroditus brought more to Paul than just a goodie basket full of Baby Ruth candy bars and maybe a couple of Dr. Peppers. I think it means that Epaphroditus came to Paul there in prison with more than just a spare razor and maybe a can of deodorant. I think it means, because of what it says here, a fragrant offering, a sacrifice acceptable and pleasing to God. It was something that was dedicated to the accomplishment of God's work of proclaiming the gospel. And so Epaphroditus had come to Paul. He had stayed there with Paul for a time, and Paul is now ready to send him back. Most commentators believe that Epaphroditus was the one who carried this letter back to the Philippian Christians from Paul. Paul is ready to send him back. He had not sent him back earlier because Epaphroditus had been sick. In fact, he had been so sick that he almost died. But I want you to notice from the text that it wasn't the fact that Epaphroditus was so sick that got to Epaphroditus. It wasn't the sickness and the discomfort and the inconvenience and even the fact that he got so sick he nearly died that really bothered him. What really bothered him is reflected there in verse 26. For he has been longing for you all and has been distressed because you heard that he was ill. This man has been so sick that he almost died, and his number one concern is, what are the brethren back home going to think when they find out I'm really bad sick? I know it's going to worry them. I know it's going to bother them. Obviously, Epaphroditus was a really, really unique man because his number one concern was to put his brethren's worries at ease about him. Well, you know, I think this brings up another good question. Why didn't Paul just make him well? Somebody says, well, it doesn't say there that Paul didn't heal him. Are you sure about that? It says in verse 27... Indeed, he was ill near to death, but God had mercy on him. I think that means that Paul didn't heal him. He got well by God's mercy. He recovered from his sickness, not because of a miracle that Paul performed. You know, there's this misunderstanding we've got, I'm afraid, about miracles and those who did miracles. Our first question is, well, Paul was an apostle. He could work miracles. Why didn't he just heal the man? Well, it was the same reason he didn't heal Timothy. When he advised him to take a little wine for his stomach's sake. The same thing was in the case of Trophimus, which Paul says in the second letter to Timothy, that he had left at Miletus sick. Apparently, Trophimus was one of the ones who traveled with Paul to Rome when he was being put in prison for the final time, during which time he wrote the second letter to Timothy. And apparently, Trophimus got sick on the way, and Paul says, we had to leave Trophimus in Miletus because he was sick. Well, why didn't you just heal him, Paul? The fact is, the miracles and the miraculous power was not for the convenience of the preacher or the apostle or whoever. It was for the purpose of confirming the word. It had an entirely different purpose, and to use it, even in such a worthy matter as to heal Timothy of the stomach trouble or to heal Trophimus or to heal Epaphroditus, who was almost dead from whatever was wrong with him, would have been wrong. Now, you know, we're very familiar these days with what's called the misappropriation, usually of money, funds, they call it. When a politician steals a bunch of money, it sounds a lot better when you refer to it as funds. He misappropriated the funds. And there have been some pretty well-known names thrown about as those who have misappropriated the funds. For Paul to have used his miraculous ability to to heal Epaphroditus would have been a misappropriation of the power to perform a miracle. Because it was not God's will that that power be used for that kind of purpose. There's one other question or one other point that we need to observe before we look at one other thing. Notice in verse 30 that Paul says, actually back up to verse 29, let's get the full sentence. So receive him in the Lord with all joy and honor such men, for he nearly died for the work of Christ, risking his life to complete what was lacking in your service to me. Doesn't that make you want to know more? Doesn't that make you want to ask a lot of questions? How did Epaphroditus risk his life for the cause of Christ? He's evidently referring to something more than just the fact that he got so sick he almost died. The word risk here, or risked, risking, is a word which implies specific action, taking a specific action so that something resulted from it. That's saying more than just the fact that Epaphroditus got sick and got so sick he almost died. Now, the question that comes to all of us is, what would we be willing to do for the cause of Christ? Would you be willing to risk your life? Well, that's an unfair question. I hope we'd all say that we'd be willing to risk our lives for the Lord because the Lord died for us and all of that. But isn't it interesting how that we'll claim that we would surely risk our lives for the Lord, but it's hard to get a lot of folks to risk their schedule and their plans to attend the services of a local gospel meeting, to come to Bible study on Wednesday night when there isn't anything hindering that taking place. How far would we go? What would we be willing to do for the work of Christ? Now, there's a second thing that I'd like for us to look at just briefly, and it's just a quick glance at the five descriptive terms that Paul uses in talking about Epaphroditus, and we find all of them up there in verse 25. First of all, he says, Epaphroditus, my brother. My brother. Now, some folks would say that's a little bit embarrassing. In fact, I've heard people actually tell me, don't call me brother so-and-so in front of that bunch of folks. Now, granted, you know, it wasn't in a church setting. It wasn't around a bunch of church people, and it was almost like this guy didn't want anybody to know that he was a Christian. Have you noticed that we tend sometimes to give earthly titles a lot more precedence over the spiritual titles? I don't think there's any greater honor than to be able to call someone brother so-and-so or sister so-and-so. But I'll be the first one to admit that's old-fashioned there. I mean, get there and at the softball game up there surrounded by all your friends and everything, and you say, hey, brother Paul, how you doing? I was at one of the Faulkner board meetings one day, and it was time to break for lunch, and we went to lunch, and the chairman of the board at that time as we all got into our seats, he said, "Dr. Phillips, would you offer thanks for the meal?" Oh, he's talking about me. I'm not a doctor, you know. I was really uneasy. I went ahead and I didn't correct him. I went ahead and led the prayer and offered thanks for the meal. But after the meal, I went up to him and I said, "Brother John, I'm not a doctor." "Well, I thought you were, because most everybody else on the board is Dr. So-and-so and Dr. So-and-so." I said, "Kind of makes you wonder why I'm here, doesn't it? But no, I'm not a doctor. Just call me Brother Phillips or Brother David." "Yeah, that's great. That's as good as I would ever want to hear." Paul says, "I'm going to send Epaphroditus, my brother, back to you." Paul says, "He is my fellow worker." My fellow worker. You know what? Before you can have workers, and especially fellow workers, you got to have something going on. What is it? It's work. You got to have some work going on in order for somebody to be a fellow worker. Now, there's no question about the fact that Paul was very much a worker for the Lord. In fact, in 1 Corinthians chapter 3, Paul refers to himself and all of those that he loves and cares for, including us today, as fellow laborers with God. I believe, if my count is correct, there are 6 individuals who are named in the New Testament by Paul that he refers to as his fellow workers or fellow laborers. I don't think there could be a higher honor than anything than to be called Paul's fellow worker. He says he's my fellow soldier. In Paul's day, very much like in our day today, everybody knew, everybody knows what a soldier is. Everybody knew, everybody knows what a soldier does. Soldiers fight. Paul said he's my fellow soldier. Now in Ephesians chapter 6 and verse 12, Paul reminds us that our fighting is not against flesh and blood, but against the spiritual powers, principalities. And it's then that he tells us that we've got to put on the whole armor of God in order to be a good soldier. Epaphroditus is my fellow soldier. He says he's your messenger. Again, this refers to the fact that Philippi had sent Epaphroditus to Paul. He came on behalf of the church there. He came because that church loved Paul very much, but not just from a personal standpoint. He came because they knew that Paul needed whatever it was that they were sending. And Epaphroditus was their messenger. He represented to Paul the church at Philippi. And so Paul wasn't in prison sitting there all by himself. He was, in a sense, in the company of the church at Philippi, because they had sent their messenger to him to be with him. And then he says, he is a minister to my need. Minister to my need. I can't pass up this opportunity to ask every single one of us, what are you a minister to? You see, we've got these funny ideas about the word minister. and ministry. Well, that's a popular term these days. Everybody's got this ministry and that ministry. Until you get ready for somebody to do something, and then everybody says, that's a minister up there, the guy who stands in the pulpit. The way I read the New Testament, every single one of us is a minister, because a minister is a servant. And we serve God in whatever ways that we have, with whatever God has blessed us with. And Paul says, He is your messenger, and He is a minister to my need. And so now you know a little bit more about why I say Epaphroditus was one of my favorite characters in all of the New Testament, in spite of the fact that we really don't know all that much about him. He was surely a good man. I would love to be remembered in the terms that Epaphroditus was referred to with by the Apostle Paul. Are you a child of God? Have you obeyed the gospel of Jesus Christ in the very same way that the people in the first century did, that we read about in the book of Acts? Obeying the gospel by believing in Jesus as God's Son, repenting of sin, confessing faith publicly, and being buried with Him in baptism to have those sins washed away. If you haven't done that, there never will be a better time than right now. If you have done that, but have become unfaithful in your service to God, and if it's quiet and private, just between you and God, straighten that out with Him before you go any further. But if it's public and well known, then you need to publicly acknowledge it and let it be known that you're not going to go in that way, that route, any longer. We're going to sing this song. We call this an invitation song. The fact is, though, the invitation of the Lord is always open, any time of the day or night, beginning or end of a worship service, or right in the middle, I suppose. I remember we baptized someone one Sunday morning before Sunday school class. Hasn't been too long ago. Where did we get the idea that you can only obey the gospel at the end of a sermon during the singing of a song? If you need to respond to the Master's invitation in any way, we invite you to do so now as we stand together and sing.